So, yeah, so since I have people in here who know what I've been up to, I thought you may find this interesting, what Pepperdine's up to, so I'll do this really quick, and I can still make Esther work, I think. So, if you haven't heard, one of the neat relationships we have that came this past year is that, for people who know kind of the Southern California LA environment, Staples Center is where the LA Kings play, the Lakers play, Clippers. Anyway, it's a huge venue. There's also LA Live there and everything. The company that owns that is called AEG, the Anschutz Entertainment Group. And they have official sponsors that they partner with. And so this past year, Pepperdine sponsored or partnered with them. So we are the official education partner for AEG, which is a big deal. It's a really big deal, and we've gotten lots of great press on that, so we're doing some things. And then the one we're working on today, we were cutting it close because the meeting was supposed to be at 11 and then they changed it to 1, so we met with LAPD and the chief of police is Charlie Beck. And so Pepperdine's doing some really cool things, both with dispute resolution, with fitness for cops, and all sorts of things. So anyway, that's the quick advertisement, but we think that's pretty cool stuff. And people we're partnering with, a lot of people are excited about that. So I'm glad to be here because it was an accident right at Duke's. And so we were sitting in traffic and trying to make it. Okay, Esther. So I want to set this up in a way to help you. One of the things that I think makes a narrative, a really good narrative, or a story, a really good story, and when I say story, don't necessarily assume a story as opposed to history. It's just the way the material is told, okay? But the five little books we're looking at, two of them for sure, I think have narratives as compelling as any narratives you will read. And that's Ruth and Esther. So that's the reason I teased Mike Cope about Ruth. What I would suggest is that really, if a narrative or a story is really told well, the next time and the third time and the fourth time you read it, if it's done well, you notice things you didn't notice before. And there are all sorts of things. The analogy I would use is students today watch movies multiple times. I typically don't do that, but the few times I've done that, you know, when you watch a movie the second time, you realize, oh, this is kind of being set up. I know where this is going. The example really quickly I'll give, since I'm not doing Ruth, but I do love Ruth, is the first time you read Ruth, you don't think much about when Boaz first meets Ruth and he says a prayer. And then the next time he encounters her is at the threshing floor. And if you recall in that narrative or in that story, he says to Ruth, what do you want me to do for you? And she says, spread your cloak over me. Okay? If you know Hebrew, interestingly, the next time you read that narrative, the first time Boaz ever prays, when he prays over Ruth, he says, may the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to dwell, or basically spread his wings over you. May he protect you. Okay? And then when you get to the narrative about Boaz saying, what do you want me to do? And she says, spread your cloak. In Hebrew, the word for wing and the word for cloak are the same. Come on. So if you follow, when you read that, you realize that Boaz now has the potential to answer his own prayer. Okay? And there are a number of things like that. You start noticing the prayer that Naomi prays that is pretty fascinating. You notice, anyway, any number of things. But each time you read it, you pick up on things. And again, in an English Bible, you don't notice this, but in the Hebrew Bible, the book that follows Proverbs is Ruth, because the little books are all put together. They're in the third section, not scattered across chronologically like in our English Bibles. And what's the last thing you get in Proverbs 31? The ideal woman. What's the very next book? Ruth. Interestingly, Ruth is described in the book of Ruth as the same terminology that you have for the ideal woman. Boaz, that terminology is used for him, but in an interesting way, it's for the wealth he has. And so one of the questions that's played out in the book of Ruth is he the worthy man more than because of his means? Okay, that's Ruth. Here we go with Esther. Same thing with Esther, okay? So all I'm saying is each time you read Esther, I would suggest that there is more than meets the eye. I'm going to assume to some degree that you're familiar with the narrative, but there are a lot of fascinating moving parts. And so what I want to do today is just sort of walk us through again the narrative in the book of Esther and try to point out a couple of things, and then we'll work through it in a little more detail. And then tomorrow, depending on how far I get today, tomorrow what I want to do is go back through and talk about some background kind of components and things we know or things that may be helpful. One of the issues, though, interestingly today, to kind of put out on the table so you can think about it, is when you read the book of Esther, how do you view, just to take two people, how do you view Mordecai and how do you view Esther? Okay? Just think about that. If you read commentaries, which you may or may not, but if you look at commentaries, say, prior to about the 1980s, pretty consistently, Mordecai is the hero, and Esther is sort of dragged along and doing the best she can, and Mordecai is doing the best he can with poor little Esther, who doesn't seem to quite get it. Okay? And so Mordecai is the hero, and Esther's, she's okay, but she's seen consistently as not really the center to the story. From about the 80s on, interestingly, Esther, in many commentaries, is the hero, and Mordecai is a problem. Okay? To take but one example that we'll hit, if you know the story well, you know one of the things that happens is that Haman, when he comes, everybody bows down except for Mordecai. And that creates a problem. Now, I don't know what you think the reason is that Mordecai doesn't kneel. It could be, or I think a number of us might think, well, you're not supposed to kneel or bow to anyone but God. But that's not correct. In Hebrew, the terminology that's used, people bow or kneel or show respect with this verb to a lot of different people. So the question is, why didn't Mordecai bow? What's going on there, and how do you think about that? Okay? So anyway, those are the kinds of things we're gonna talk about and deal with some and have a good time with. The other is just how you picture what's going on here. How do you picture Ahasuerus? How do you picture Haman? Again, it's a narrative that I want to suggest is written incredibly well and very, very engaging. And last night I slipped and referred to, you know, Esther having to deal with a bunch of idiots. That probably wasn't the best way to put it, but that's the most accurate way to put it. One of the things I want to suggest is, as you read through, how are people depicted? You know, what's your picture of Ahasuerus? Okay, and how is he seen in all this? So, in chapter 1, we are introduced to the Persian court, and it's a pretty fascinating crew. It's all about partying. In fact, one of the ways you can see markers or lines in the book of Esther is festivals. The Persians seem to be big on festivals, and so they're always having these festivals. Meanwhile, the Jews, for whatever reason, are engaging in fasts. But then there's a turn in the book where suddenly Jews are engaging in festivals, and you can tell those kinds of things. So one of the things you want to look when you read the book is, you know, who's doing what and when do the transitions take place? The other thing that you may want to notice is who's wearing what, and does that indicate status and what's happening, if things are going well or not going well based on the attire they have, and how do you understand that? So we have in chapter 1, we're introduced to the Persian court. In chapter 2, and you get that famous line that I'm going to come back to, or that famous moment where Ahasuerus is having this big festival. On and on it goes, and next thing you know, he decides Queen Vashti should come and entertain him and his drunken buddies. Okay? And she, for whatever reason, refuses. And this creates a crisis. Interestingly, one of the things you'll notice as we read through is everything, anything that happens has the potential to be escalated off the charts. So the fact that Vashti simply refuses the king's request is at a particular level. Next thing you know, this has the potential, if she won't obey the queen, I mean won't obey the king, then women everywhere are going to lose all restraint. And so the next thing you know, an edict is issued that all women must obey their husbands. Even though, interestingly, the queen is not obeying her husband. And she refused to come before her husband, and so for her punishment, she will not be allowed to come before her husband. This is why I refer to the Persian Empire, or the way the Persian Empire is depicted, as a bunch of clowns, actually. I mean, if there's one characteristic trait that you see with Ahasuerus, he's about as clueless as you could have for a king, and he engages in excess. Okay, so again, notice as we move through, what are the character traits of different people? So, because Vashti is now banished, Ahasuerus needs another queen. Next thing we know, we have Esther, who comes into the mix. Interestingly, Esther is told by her uncle, by Mordecai, when you go in, do not let them know you're Jewish. So she goes in and becomes queen, ostensibly as a Persian. And that's of some interest because, you know, when we get to chapter 4, that one of the issues is, how is Esther going to engage the issue that they've got in front of them if she's Persian? Or is she Jewish? And Mordecai, who told her, don't let them know you're Jewish, will play the card in chapter 4, you better stand up and be counted. Okay? So it's an interesting kind of dynamic. That's why I say, you know, how do you understand Mordecai? How do you understand Esther? How does this play out? We get this interesting moment, though. She becomes queen. We begin chapter 3. Mordecai happens to overhear a conversation where a couple of the officers of the eunuchs in the king's court are plotting treason. And again, it's interesting to watch as you read through the book. Who knows what and when do they know it? And so they plot treason. Mordecai tells Esther, she tells the king, and she tells the king in Mordecai's name. So we now know that the king knows Mordecai is the one who discovered the plot or whatever. Those two guys are gone, but it is forgotten, or it's put in the books, but nothing is done on behalf of Mordecai. And immediately after that, we are told, Haman is elevated to an incredibly high spot in the empire. And no reason is given why he's elevated. He's just elevated. Okay? So, we jump forward, and we find out that because Mordecai is not bowing down to Haman, Haman decides, he finds out Mordecai is Jewish. Again, you would think, since you've got one person not bowing down to you, you would deal with that one person. But that's not the way the Persian Empire works. And so Haman decides, if this one guy is such a pest to him, he will simply have the entire Jewish population wiped out. Which is where we get the term overkill. Anyway, I mean, think about it. That's just kind of nonsense, right? If you think about it, and yet that's what's going on. But Haman, who gets the king to agree, and they write a decree, and we'll come back in a couple of minutes and talk about the date of the decree, because that will be very significant. We're told very specific dates as we move through the book of Esther when things happen. So we're told the date when the decree was issued, that all Jews, women and children, everyone, will not only be killed, they will be annihilated, there are about three verbs used for wiping them out when you could just say, we're going to kill them all. Okay? So again, it's excess. But in that then, we find that Esther now engages. And again, because festivals or banquets or dinners are such a big part, she has two dinners, actually, for Ahasuerus the king and for Haman. And if you know the story well, at the second one, she discloses the plight of her people, and Haman, who thinks he's on the fast track to success, suddenly finds the tables are turned. He makes a move. We'll come back and talk about it. He falls at Esther's feet. Ahasuerus, the king, for whatever reason. Ahasuerus is always misinterpreting things. Again, he's clueless. He comes in, he misreads the situation, and next thing you know, Haman is killed, and the gallows, as it's translated, on which he was hoping Mordecai would be displayed, he is displayed. And so then you have this interesting moment. The edict is still out there, and so another edict is written. We'll talk some about that. And in that, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And so you have what's called the pogrom prevented. We're told how many people lost their lives, how it played out, and what happened. Okay, so that's kind of a quick overview, and then we're going to start working our way back through. Interestingly, this book has been a challenge both in Judaism and in Christianity. In Judaism, usually when it's talked about the challenges of the book of Esther, it's the challenge is that God is not mentioned. In Christianity, the challenge of this book is the pretty vindictive or revengeful manifestation at the end when people are killed. And so, you know, what do you do with a book that's kind of celebrating that and talking about that? And so both of those become a fairly significant factor. Okay, let's work our way through and go back through and talk some about this. So the, get the rest spot here. So the first thing we have, chapter 1, is Ahasuerus Feast. And again, it's a book of banquets. You have banquets at the beginning, you have them at the middle, and you have them at the end. And one of the things I want to emphasize is excess. Because think about it, we are told, I mean, this banquet goes on forever. And everybody, apparently, or all the men in the empire are at this banquet. I mean, if you think about that, it's just kind of ludicrous. It's almost absurd to think every male in the empire is having this extended banquet for day after day, week after week after week. It's sort of like, you know, who's minding the store? Ahasuerus, who, as best we can tell, well, we know, Ahasuerus is the Hebrew term for Xerxes. So the Persian king we're talking about is Xerxes the One. We know how long, or, you know, when he reigned. It was 486 to 465. Okay, so the date of the banquet would be 483. And again, the book begins and ends with banqueting. We have it here at the beginning in chapter 1. In chapter 9, we'll have a banquet as well. And banquets are where you get the turning point in the middle of the book as well. So every time a banquet's coming, you know, something big is in the offing. Now, so they're having this, this thing is excess. Notice, it's just opulence, you know, to the extreme. The amount of money, all the stuff that's just piled up over and over and over, how much they drink, you know, what they're doing and everything. Meanwhile, while Ahasuerus is having his banquet for the guys, Vashti apparently is having her own banquet for the women, and that's when Ahasuerus decides, after they've had quite a bit to drink, that he would love to bring her and show her off. And all it says is that he wanted her to come and to wear the crown when she came. So you always get these kind of fun interpretive asides. Is it that he wanted to make sure everyone knew she was the queen? Or, you know, some interpreters love to think that what he's asking is her to come wearing only her crown. Whatever. Vashti clearly knows that she is being objectified, and that's why she's being brought in front of these guys. And so she will have none of it. She refuses. Okay? Now, what's interesting about that is, or there are a number of things, but if you step back and think about it, Vashti, then, for many of us, is a hero.
Yes.
Okay? She is heroic. Her heroic act causes her to be dismissed. We never hear of Vashti again. And so that's an interesting aspect of the book, is by doing the right thing, she loses her voice. And she loses power and control. Esther, on the other hand, will be put into that mix and will handle it differently. And so one of the things you get in the book of Esther is this is pretty murky, kind of, this is pretty fascinating trudging going through this. But one of the things you have, again, is you have this banquet with all the wealth, with all the status, with all the power of the king. You're dealing with that. Over and over, you'll see this. Haman boasts about his wealth and his status. Apparently, people are really into stuff in the book of Esther. Now, as you think about it, then one of the things you see is played out the character of Ahasuerus, or lack, I think, and you get similarities with Haman. So let me show some of these. For example, let's just take Ahasuerus and Haman. And this is where I say, stories that are really well written, each time you read them, you pick up on things. So these are just a few, not the only ones. Ahasuerus has this crass desire to show off his wife. Haman, the first time we meet him, has this tremendous desire to show off how close he is to the king. The same terminology is used, okay? Vashti refuses to bow down or to refuses to appear before the king, and that's paralleled in some ways by Mordecai refusing to bow down to Haman. So again, one of the things the writer does is use terminology in such a way that when you're hearing that Vashti refuses to appear, and then the next time you hear the word refuse, it's like, oh, Mordecai is making the same move that Vashti made in a different setting, okay? Take it a little farther. Haman will die this terrible death, this humiliating death. Ahasuerus, on the other hand, you know, thrives and survives, so he makes it through this. There is no question that Haman is presented as kind of this active evil force. Ahasuerus, I would suggest, on the other hand, is presented throughout the book of Esther as weak, spineless, clueless. And think about that. You are, in this book, presenting the king of the greatest empire on the earth. The Persian Empire is massive. It rules the known world at that time. This is the guy who is at the top of the heap, and this is how he's presented, as not having a clue about what it means to be king. Paralleling, in a way, no sooner are we told that Vashti loses her office, eventually, in the book, Mordecai will gain an office. Same terminology used. And so Vashti is paired in contrastive fashion with Esther. Vashti, the Persian queen, makes this move that is right. And because of that, she sort of exits and we never see her again. Esther gets in the middle of stuff. And, you know, we'll have a point where, in fact, the opposite, where Vashti refuses to heed the bid of the king. And you remember when Mordecai wants Esther to do something, interestingly, Esther says, I can't go. I haven't been bidden by the king. And Mordecai says, you got to make a tough call here. Make the right one. So we're going to kind of deal with or think about some of that. Because she is because Vashti is banished, interestingly, we may see her as heroic. In the ancient materials, Vashti is portrayed negatively, both in Jewish literature and in Christian literature. Now, the reasons for that are probably not correct. In the Talmud, in the Jewish Talmud, the reason Vashti gets panned is because she is understood to be the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. May or may not be, but that's why, you know, so if you're the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, if you know Nebuchadnezzar, nothing good can come from Nebuchadnezzar. Interestingly, the rabbis also, again, they tend to elaborate this stuff, and so they love to tell this narrative that the reason that she deserved to be stripped and to be humiliated was because she was being bidden on the seventh day. And they tell this story that Vashti used to like to bring all the Jewish women and have them stripped bare every seventh day to humiliate them. There's no evidence for this, but, you know, you're trying to justify why things happen the way they have. But anyway, we have a state crisis. So this is quite frankly, I think, one of the most enjoyable or fun moments. This is where you know you're reading really good literature. So there's a crisis, and Ahasuerus, because Ahasuerus tends not to be pretty clueless, he's always bringing in his advisors, and you get their names and everything. So he brings the guy in, and the guy says, okay, we've got a huge problem. When word breaks, or if word breaks throughout the empire, what Vashti has done, that she has done this, created this act of rebellion, women everywhere are going to rebel. Now, think about that. That's kind of interesting. You are not in the modern world where you have instantaneous news. I mean, we're dealing with the opposite, right, with social media. We know long before we probably should, what's going on. Okay, or what may not be going on, but what people think is going on. You're in the ancient world. You know virtually nothing about what happens, because think much more in terms of state-controlled press and, who handles the press. It's the king, right? And so in a very real sense, you could make the case that who is going to know that Vashti didn't come? I mean, Ahasuerus is surrounded by a bunch of guys who are drunk. It is not hard to create a narrative that would get you out of this. And yet, the route they seem to go is word will spread like wildfire what Vashti has done, and so we've got to address it. And in the Persian, or in this narrative, every time you address something, you address it to the nth degree. You just escalate everything. That's the common thing. And so the decision is, how do we deal with this? Let's issue an edict. Apparently the Persians love edicts. And so the edict that they issue is that a rule will go out now that every wife must obey her husband. Men will be kings of their castles. Okay? Now, think about that. If you step back, I want to make the case, because sometimes I think people struggle with this. I think there's a lot of material in the Bible that you're supposed to really smile or laugh about. Then you really are supposed to say, this is incredibly enjoyable, and this is quite ludicrous, okay? I know that's not, we often think that when we read biblical materials, everything's just really straight away serious, and you should never think, wow, this is as goofy as it can be. But if you step back, think, if you were writing this and you're Jewish, you've got to enjoy telling the story that the king of Persia issues an edict that men will rule their houses, and the one male who cannot rule his own house is the king of Persia. And so what does he do? The way he addresses the situation is, he says, okay, Vashti can never come before me again. Well, she didn't want to come before him in the first place. So, think about it. That's kind of a funny punishment. Okay? It's like being thrown in the briar patch or something. I mean, that's what you have going on here. And so, So you have that. So we have this kind of crisis that's been created. She's banished. Again, this contract between the royal splendor, the royal edict. And now we turn to chapter 2. And again, the language is telling, apparently Ahasuerus has a bad temper. He's enraged by what has happened. And the rage, notice again the time frame, how long his anger is. Because Vashti is banished, and then Esther will become queen by about year 4. Well, interestingly, we are told that when Ahasuerus finally calmed down, he was finally able to remember why he was so mad. I mean, that's kind of an interesting dynamic, isn't it? You're incredibly mad, you can't remember what you're mad about, and then you finally calm down, and suddenly you remember what you're mad about, and so here you go again. And the courtiers again realize they got to do something with this guy. And so they say, why don't you bring another queen? And he remembers, we are told, what Vashti used to do. One of the wonderful things about narrative is sometimes it's written in a way that it's not completely clear. And the question is, what exactly does he remember about what Vashti used to do? This is a guy who is completely self-absorbed, he's narcissistic, he is completely caught up in stuff, okay? And he objectifies women. So then the question is, how much of that do you bring to this ambiguous statement, he remembers what she used to do, and so they say, you need a queen. And the edict goes out. Again, he does things off the charts, right? He's already got a harem, but they scour the kingdom for every eligible young woman, and Esther gets pulled into that. And in that narrative, remember, it's Mordecai that tells Esther, don't tell them that you're Jewish. Okay? Interestingly, we are never told Mordecai's Jewish name. So we just get kind of this one. And Esther, we are told her Jewish name, Hadassah, which means myrtle, but she goes by Esther all the time. But again, notice as you move through in this discussion, the living conditions of the Persians versus the Jews, and then how women are treated. So the first time we're introduced to Esther, we find out that she is the cousin of Mordecai. She's an orphan, and so her cousin, who one would assume is somewhat older, has sort of adopted her and looks out for her. So you have Ahasuerus who objectifies and manipulates women, and then you have Mordecai who has taken her in and cares for her. But then the other one is that we're introduced to a guy named Haman, eventually, okay? And nothing is done without purpose. We are told Haman is an Agagite, okay? And we are told Mordecai the Jew is from the lineage of Saul. So far, so good. Now, you may not be, if you're not up to speed on Agagites and Saulites and everything, you remember King Saul. King Saul had some issues, and one of the things he did one time was he did not follow the Lord, and he spared the life of a king, Amalek. Okay? And that came back to bite him. He ended up losing his life because of that act of disobedience. So far, so good? Mordecai is a descendant of Saul. That's his lineage. That's what's in his genes, okay? The Agagites are descendants of Amalek, the guy that Saul spared. Okay? So that's what's in his genes. And so this is not simply Mordecai against Haman. The writer wants to make sure you know this is Mordecai, who is a descendant of Saul, having to deal with Haman, who is a descendant of Amalek, who created ultimately the undoing of Saul. And so you can already see where this is going to begin to play out and how different they are. And they are dramatically different, Haman and Mordecai. So, remember, the theme is everything is done to excess, and so apparently before these young women can even be presented before the king, to make sure that they genuinely look the way he wants them to look, they need cosmetic treatment for a year. So I won't go down that road, you know, tempting as that might be, but that is an interesting aside, right? Everything's to excess. And so apparently, if you're a woman, you're not truly presentable. It takes a year to get you truly presentable in the Persian Empire, okay? And then you start being brought through, and as you are brought through, Ahasuerus apparently critiques and decides where he's going with all this, and out of that, Esther is the one he selects. So what we know about Esther so far is she apparently is good-looking.
How old is she?
I have no idea. I would go with young. Teens, okay? Late teens, something early 20s maybe. Now, the big question, though, that question is of some interest. I think the really interesting one, though, is what I've got here is, remember, he just banished Vashti for not being a docile woman. And so the question is, has Ahasuerus now found his docile woman? And that really is kind of an interesting one. Is this someone who can be manipulated and who will do what he thinks the queen should really do? And so that's kind of how that's being set up. Hold that, and then we jump to, again, the story I told earlier that apparently a couple of guys, a couple of courtiers are plotting an assassination. It kind of makes sense given Ahasuerus and kind of the way he's presented in this narrative. But Mordecai uncovers the plot. He tells Esther. So interestingly, this time, in this scenario, Mordecai knows things that Esther, Mordecai on the outside knows things that Esther on the inside doesn't know. Which is interesting in the story as you read through. Notice who knows what. When does Mordecai, and how does Mordecai sometimes know more than Esther knows on the inside? And, you know, probably has a lot to do with how harems work and the Persian Empire and some of that. But anyway, Mordecai unfolds it. Esther tells Ahasuerus, and so it is resolved. But it's made very clear that although it is written in the books or in the annals what Mordecai has done to deliver the king, nothing is done. No action is taken other than we know clearly it's Mordecai who resolved the issue. And then you get this jarring moment. The reason that's such a big deal is the jarring moment then is we're immediately told Haman, or introduced to Haman, and he is elevated. And nothing is ever said about what Haman did to be elevated. And so it's what sometimes the line is, you have the contrast between merited neglect and unmerited reward. Okay? And so you have Mordecai who did something that really should have been recognized or acknowledged, and nothing happens. And then Haman just sort of springs up from nowhere, and he receives all of this, you know, kind of plus or everything that goes on with it. So again, it's you're kind of in an interesting moment. Now, see if I have anything else I want to... Let's jump into chapters 3 and 4. So, I said this wrong. Unrewarded merit. One of the things that's interesting is, as you read narratives, is that there are a lot of stories in ancient Israel. And so, when you're reading Esther, sometimes the question is, are you supposed to hear echoes of other narratives, earlier narratives? And the one I've listed here is simply the story about Joseph. So as you read through, remember, you remember Joseph's narrative? Just like in the book of Esther, you can kind of tell people's status by what they're wearing and what they receive. In the book of Joseph, or in the story of Joseph, you remember, you can tell really clearly how things are going for Joseph in a couple of ways. One, what he has on. Every time things go bad for Joseph, his clothes get torn. Remember? The brothers throw him in the pit. They shred the favored jacket, put wood on it. He's in trouble. He gets to Egypt, gets sold to Potiphar. Things are going pretty well. We're told Potiphar gives him a nice new set of clothes. Things are looking good. And the next thing you know, you have Potiphar's wife. And how do we know he's in trouble again? She grabs his coat and rips it as he runs away. Okay? And then eventually things go really well because he is given the royal robe when he becomes vizier of Egypt. But the other way, you know, with Joseph is the language pit. So Joseph's thrown into the pit, he comes out of the pit. Interestingly, when he gets thrown into jail after the Potiphar episode, it's referred to as the pit. Okay? You have something very similar in Esther as you watch how she comes and goes, and you know what's being worn and everything. But part of what you have in that whole dynamic is that you see the contrasting plight of the Jews and the Persians. Again, Persians are feasting, the Jews are fasting. You have this dynamic where Mordecai refuses to bow. And as I mentioned earlier, the term that's used here is not the term that's used about refusing to bow to an idol. It's a term that's used like Abraham shows obeisance and he bows. So it's a term that if someone came before and you show respect. So now the question is, why didn't Mordecai do that? And that's why I say, one of the things we'll grapple with tomorrow is, who do you think the heroes are? One way to read Mordecai is, he triggers this whole crisis. All he had to do was show respect, and he doesn't. Or is he a person of integrity and says, this is not a person you show respect to, and triggers a crisis? So again, we saw, one of the things you grapple with as you go through the book of Esther is Vashti, apparently, who knows what her thinking is, but she makes a very principled stand. We know what she did. I don't know quite why she did it, but we know what she did. Mordecai is similar. We know what he did. Is this a principled stand? And then the question is, what are the repercussions of doing that? And one of the things when you read, you get to grapple with is this a good idea, a bad idea? Is Mordecai not bowing? The one thing we know that's pretty clear is we do know what makes Haman tick. What makes Haman tick is he obsesses over the smallest thing that doesn't line up the way he likes it to line up. Again, you've got healthy characters in this book, and you have people who just have big-time problems. Haman is as big as they get. This is the, you know, this is the equivalent, but some of us, everyone could tell us how wonderful we are, and one person walks along and sort of says, hey, you're okay, and we focus completely on that person, right? I mean, that's Haman. Everybody is bowing down to him. He's got one guy, and that's the only guy he notices. And you know he's got a big-time problem because instead of addressing the specific issue of Mordecai, what does he do? He decides he will get an edict, and the edict will be, let's just wipe them all out. I mean, that's just mind-boggling, isn't it? But we know that, again, the way that's being presented in the narrative is, that's not atypical for the Persians. Because when Vashti does something that Ahasuerus doesn't like, rather than deal with Vashti, they issue this edict that all women must obey, you know, all women obey the men. You kind of, you fix everything with a sledgehammer, so to speak. Okay? And so that's what Haman decides he's going to do. Let's just wipe them out. Even though you've only got one guy who's doing that, you really kind of wonder how he might have been perceived among his buddies or whatever. Now, so he does get royal approval. Again, one of the big things in all of this is we begin to learn that in Persia, once you issue a royal edict, it cannot be revoked. Now, think about that. I mean, I'm going to make as much fun as I can of this, but what kind of world or what kind of empire do you want to live in where you issue an edict and it can never be revoked? You can never change your mind. You can never say, this was a bad idea. This was a mistake. That's the Persian Empire. I mean, again, if you're Jewish, it's ludicrous to think you are subject to an empire that is this clueless. Ahasuerus, and to show how goofy you see it, the writer doesn't want you to miss. Later, Ahasuerus apparently could give away half his empire, but he can't revoke his own decree. I mean, that's just absurd, if you think of it, right? But that's what you're looking at in this whole thing. So we know we've got this decree going out that's just off the charts. It makes no sense whatsoever. And in that context, then, you've got this irrevocable decree, and you've got this crisis that clearly is going to occur. And then, as an aside, we are told the date when the edict was issued. Okay? Which is kind of odd. You know, why would you say, oh, by the way, this happened on this date? Again, if you're Jewish, a bell goes off that the edict when you are going to be slaughtered is the day before Passover. The plan in the Persian Empire is to slaughter you the day before you will celebrate the greatest deliverance, the biggest story you have in your history, the Exodus from Egypt, and God toppling the Egyptians in the Red Sea. And if that isn't good enough, So that's pretty interesting, and if that isn't good enough, the other thing that you're told is that the reason that this occurred or this date is picked is because these Persians cast the lot, and it's fate. Okay? So here's where I'll end. reading between the lines, one of the fun things in the ancient world is we see this with the Assyrians, with the Persians, with the Babylonians. People were always trying to predict the future and to figure out what were good decisions, how to decide whether you should go with yes, no, or what decisions you should make. And there were three ways, typically, in those empires that you could figure this stuff out. The first one is kind of a two-parter, has two different ways you can do it. It's called extaspasi. Okay, anyone know that? You're going to love this. So here's how you decide the future or how to make decisions. You take an animal, you slice it open, and you pull out the liver. And you read the liver. Liver omens, okay? Because from what I understand, we need doctors in here, but apparently livers come in all sorts of shapes, and they have spots on them and everything. And so you develop these extensive lists so that you look at this liver, and it's like, you know, oblong with the big end up, and it's got three dots on the top, two on the bottom. Go to war on the fourth day. You know. Silly as that sounds, I mean, over a period of time. And that's what priests in ancient, in Assyria, Babylon, and the Persian Empire often did. They read liver omens, or they slice open birds, and they read the entrails. Again, this is outside of my field, but I mean the birds, not this. Okay? Because apparently the entrails often line up in a lot of different ways. So you look at it, and if you know the intestines are crooked this way or that way, then you know what to do. Now, that may sound as goofy as it can be to you, but the third way they figured things out, two of those have gone by the wayside, I think. I don't know any people today who practice the first two. The third one is hanging tough, and that's astrology. Why astrology? Because when you look at the stars, they line up in any number of different ways. And so the poor, or the casting of the lot, is somewhat in that arena. Okay? And so one of the questions you have to ask yourself is, if you're going to bet the farm, are you going to bet the farm on fate and the Persian casting of the lots, or are you going to bet the farm on God and Passover? How do you think this is going to play out? And so the writer is letting you know, that's the reason he tells you the date. He's letting you know that, oh, by the way, this stuff is going to come down right when we're going to be celebrating Passover. Okay? And so the final thing, and then we are out of here, is when Mordecai comes to Esther and tells her, you have to get in front of the king. And she says, he hasn't asked for me in a long time. And if you go in there unbidden, you get killed. Okay? And Mordecai, remember, says, if you don't do this, everyone's going to get killed. And you're going to be exposed, which is interesting. Exposed, in other words, it's going to become clear that you are Jewish. Now, again, think about that. That's an interesting perspective from Mordecai, who was the one who said, don't tell them you're Jewish. She's been doing, to this point, Esther has done everything that Mordecai has asked her to do. And so this is the famous line, for many scholars will argue, this is as close as you get to God in the book of Esther. Who, if you keep silence, relief and deliverance will come for Jews from another quarter. Another quarter, many scholars think, you know, would be from the Lord. Perhaps, who knows, perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. So the question is, you know, how will Esther be? Now, tomorrow we'll get through the rest of this quickly, and then I want to do, you know, develop characters and talk about that and kind of what's going on in the book theologically and all of that. But one of the things is you read the book of Esther, notice up to this point, Mordecai has been calling the shots, and he's told Esther what to do. Interestingly, from this point forward, Esther calls all the shots. Okay? So, what I want to leave you with is the quintessential, if you wanted to say, give me a description of someone who is absolutely powerless in the ancient world, what would you give? One option would be a foreign female. And Esther is a foreign female in a world of a bunch of powerful but clueless men. And the question is, how's that going to play out? Okay, see you tomorrow. Have a great rest of the afternoon.